The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made our start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Wittison. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Wittison.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program, and I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. We have a terrific guest back with us today, Dr. Avi Loeb. We have a hard break at about 80 minutes after we start, so I'm going to skip almost all of the front end so we can spend the maximum time talking with our guest today. But if you would like to talk to Dr. Loeb, it is 1-866-687-7223. You can also send him an email at drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can post a comment on our blog, which is on our homepage. Go to Upcoming Show Menu, and this is the first program there. Open it up. You scroll down to the bottom, and you can post to your heart's content. And as soon as you hit the send button, I will be able to get your message and integrate it into our discussion today. Please note that all of our newsletters and all of the business for the coming week are posted. You'll find it all, as usual, on our website. Remember also that we're a 501c3 nonprofit with One Giant Leap Foundation. If you're a federal taxpayer and you donate to us, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true for most states. But do check to see if your state recognizes the nonprofit status of a nonprofit in another state. It's a state-by-state process, and I don't know the rules for all 50 states. So real quickly, Dr. Avi Loeb is back with us. He's a professor of science at Harvard and obviously a best-selling author. He's been on our show 3 times, I believe, or maybe 4, with some of his books. He has his PhD in physics from Hebrew University in Jerusalem at the age of only 24. He is on today basically because he started a new project dear to my heart and dear to the heart of a lot of other Space Show listeners, the Galileo Project, and that's what we're going to talk to Professor Loeb about. You can read his full bio. It is on the Space Show website. We would rather spend the rest of our time talking with Dr. Loeb. Avi, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
It is really unusual to see someone such as yourself, and especially at Harvard, take on the Galileo Project. And in your goals, which are on your website, number 2, you're talking about searching for extraterrestrial origin with the UAP phenomenon and the Navy videos and all of what we refer to on the Space Show as Tic Tac. And you have an incredible team behind you. You have a lot of courage, that's all I can say. Tell us about Project Galileo and how you put it together and what you really hope to do.
Well, I would not call it courage. I would call it a lesson that I've learned throughout my life. I'm about to be 60 years old in a week, and the biggest lesson I learned was instead of focusing on our past accomplishments and medals and honors that we received in the past, we should focus on the time left and therefore, focus on substance. And the biggest question I would like to know the answer to is, are we the smartest kid on the cosmic block? You know, that's the fundamental question. And if we are not, that would change our future, and it will be the biggest discovery of humanity. And given that, and given that there are reports on unusual objects like UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena, but also the first interstellar object seemed to be unlike any of the rocks that we had seen previously in the solar system. The name was Oumuamua, and, because the object was discovered by a telescope in Hawaii, and that means a scout in the Hawaiian language. So I worked on that object, and that brought me into the subject. And then, as we all know, about half a year ago, the Director of National Intelligence delivered a report to Congress that led to the to President Biden signing into law a new office in government that will start operations by June 2022, this year, within 4 months, that will basically coordinate the assembly of data on UAP. And if the government is willing to allocate funds to such a study, or at least assembly of data, and the government is the most conservative organization you can think of, then it's about time for scientists to be engaged in this and focus on substance rather than ridiculing the subject and having a stigma on it. So I'm here basically to serve in trying to figure out the answer to what the nature of these objects is, and, you know, without an agenda, without having a prejudice, just getting better data using telescope systems. And that's the spirit of the Galileo project. We are purchasing right now instruments that we will put together on the roof of the Harvard College Observatory as the first telescope system. And then once it works the way we want it, we will make copies of it and distribute them in many locations. And the goal is to get better data than those videos that we've all seen and that are not conclusive, you know. Now, it's possible the government has much better data, but it's classified, and the whole spirit of science is to have open data, and everyone would be able to see what we are discussing, and that's the goal of the Galileo project, because the sky is not classified, and we are aiming to look at those, find these objects, and figure out their nature. It's sort of like a fishing expedition, and, you know, if we find only sardines, these are fish that are not particularly exciting, so be it, but there is also a chance that we'll find very unusual fish up there.
So if most of these UAP sightings are around military activity, and most of it's been confined to the Navy, we're strangely silent from the Air Force, which I think is really weird. How do you get better data? You aren't going to be out there with the Navy ships and planes, or are you?
No, the point is you have to keep in mind that these UAP reports are correlated with the places where people are looking up. That's all. So there are many more eyes at the sky near military constellations. That's all. And if you look at the civilian UAP reports, they are very tightly correlated with where, with population, you know, where people are. If you look at the distribution of UAP reports, it's clear that it's exactly correlated with the population density. So in regions where there are more people, you have more reports. At least within the U.S., where everyone has roughly the same access to cell phones, you know. Of course, there are countries where technology is not as distributed as here, and of course you have fewer reports. But the point is, I basically think fundamentally that it's the reason we heard mostly from the military is because that's where the military is, concentrated in those sites, and as a result, you know, they see things that they don't fully understand, and it doesn't mean that these things are only there. And of course, there are also reports from places like Catalina Island, you know, the Nimitz incident. That's not a military facility, and we can put the telescope there, no problem. And so we could go to places that are not classified, are not limited to military personnel, and see what we find out there.
Do you have an idea of what these projects are? So we do cover this on the Space Show, and everybody has an opinion as to what they are, and you know, a couple of them do think they're extraterrestrial. Most everybody else has much more of a mundane or terrestrial or artifact type of explanation for them. Do you have any preconceived idea of what you think these objects might be and the kind of physics that they're displaying, which are not known physics by any means?
So even though as a young kid I really was fascinated by philosophy, I don't think, you know, as a physicist, I don't think it's a philosophical question. We don't need to debate it. All we need to do is get a megapixel image of such an object, and then we know what it is. You see, now we have the technologies that allow us to figure out the nature of things, and we just need to get either to build a big enough telescope such that we can see them at a distance with very high resolution, or come close to them, that's all, and get and snap photograph. And there is no point in arguing what I think or what other people think about what they might be, because that doesn't lead anywhere. You know, we can argue forever, but the point is to look through the telescope. And that's a lesson, by the way, that was already suggested by Galileo Galilei. That's why we call it the Galileo Project, because Galileo said to philosophers at the time that, please look through my telescope and you might be convinced that the Earth moves around the Sun. And they said, no, we know that the Sun moves around the Earth. We don't need to look through your telescope. They put him in house arrest, and today they would have canceled him on social media. And if you were to ask these philosophers to design a rocket that would reach Mars, they would never get their destination, because they thought that Mars moves around the Earth. So they had the wrong conception of reality. And my point to these philosophers is, it's not a philosophical question. Whether Mars moves around the Earth is not a question you can address by arguing in a closed room forever. You will never figure it out. The only way to figure it out is actually what you didn't do, philosophers, which was four centuries ago, to look through Galileo's telescope. You didn't do that, and therefore you held the wrong opinion. And, of course, you know, they could have been politically powerful at the time, but today nobody remembers the names of these philosophers. People remember the name of Galileo. Why? Because he was right. Reality is whatever it is. And if we don't look for our telescopes, if we don't look for our windows, we might claim we are the smartest in the universe, there is nobody else around us. But not looking for our windows will not get rid of our neighbors. And, you know, it's very easy to argue Albert Einstein was the smartest scientist ever. And my point is, he was probably not the smartest scientist since the Big Bang, because most stars formed billions of years before the Sun, and there could have been another scientist on another planet a billion years ago that was smarter than Einstein. And that civilization that hosted that scientist may have sent probes that reached us by now, because a billion years is a very long time. So how do we know whether we live in that reality or not? You know, we can sit in a room and argue forever. And people can cancel other people on social media. They can do whatever they want, just like the philosophers did to Galileo. They basically didn't want anyone to hear his views. But that doesn't matter. Reality is whatever it is. You know, that will not get rid of those civilizations, the fact that we argue that they don't exist. So my point is, let's learn the lesson from Galileo's day, build telescopes, and figure out the answer through evidence, through data. That's the scientific method. Anyone that objects to that approach is basically objecting to science. And I'm, you know, surprised to see some scientists arguing against it.
I hear from a lot of them who say it's all nonsense, but that's another story. What is the progress, that's the word I'm looking for your Galileo project? I know you announced it late last year. And so what are your near-term goals? I know you've got a very impressive team. You've got research associates that I know who most of them are. A couple of them have been guests on the show, including your advisory board. And, you know, it's very impressive to me, but it's also a topic I really love. So what are you doing, and what's next, and Are you like in full swing so far, or are you gearing up? Give us sort of an update.
Yes, so I'm very encouraged by the response because we announced the project at the end of July 2021, and back then a few multi-billionaires visited the porch of my home. They were inspired by my book, Extraterrestrial, which focused on Oumuamua. And so they were inspired by the vision. They provided me with $2 million that allowed me to establish this project. And soon afterwards, there were lots of scientists that volunteered to help with the project. By now, we have more than 100 scientists. We have more about 400 volunteers that contacted us. So there is a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of expertise involved in the project. And we are making steady progress. So we designed the telescope system, the first one that we want to use, and that includes taking a video of the sky in the infrared, in the optical band, and in the radio, and also in the audio. And we plan to assemble all these components on the roof of the Harvard College Observatory in the coming months, such that by summer 2022, we will have an operating system that will be assisted by artificial intelligence, algorithms, machine learning, so that we can tell the difference between a bird, a drone, an airplane, or something else. So the main idea is to first check if an object is natural, whether it's a bird or maybe lightning or a rock coming from the sky like a meteor is. So these are natural phenomena, and, you know, we know what they are and we can look for them. And if it's not that, we need to ascertain whether it's human-made, whether it's a drone, whether it's an airplane, a piece of a satellite or some space trash that was human-made. And if we rule out that as well, then as Sherlock Holmes argued, whatever remains must be the truth. So it must be something else. If it's not natural, not human-made, then maybe someone else made it from far away. And that's the kind, I mean, we don't need to know how it works, but the first approach is simply to rule out things that we're familiar with. And hopefully we'll see something else. But it's not guaranteed. We will report whatever we find. And my hope is that within a year or two, we will have something interesting to say once those telescope systems operate. We need funding at a higher level than we have right now. We have $2 million. That would allow us maybe 5 telescope systems. But what we want is hundreds of them. And for that, the goal is to get donations of up to 100 million such that we can have hundreds of systems deployed and then cover enough of the sky to get good statistics on these unidentified aerial phenomena.
Are you a nonprofit in your structure? How are you securing or raising the funding?
Yeah, all the funds go through my research fund at Harvard University, which is a nonprofit organization. So we have a channel for contributions, and in fact, on the website of the Galileo Project, there is a tab that says support us, and it allows contributions. And the idea, this is a scientific project where, you know, we mainly invest in instrumentation. We don't invest in people because we have a lot of volunteers. So it's really trying to get as much data as possible about those objects and try to figure out what they are in an open fashion so that the public will know everything we know, unlike classified information that the public has no access to.
You have an initial question from by email from a listener, Todd, in San Diego. And Todd says, I'm wondering how you treat or do you think about or what do you do with the unusual performance characteristics assigned to these objects, which seem to defy any known laws of physics? Do you do anything with that information? Do you just dismiss it? Or how do you handle information like that in your survey?
Yeah, so the data that is currently publicly available is not conclusive. It doesn't say whether the phenomena obeys or doesn't obey the laws of physics, because we have no control over the instruments that were used to assemble that data. For example, if you have a camera in the jittery cockpit of a fighter jet, you can't tell what the object itself that is being seen is doing, because the camera is moving around. So maybe the image moves around the way that, you know, the cockpit is moving in the opposite direction. So you can't really tell whether you're looking at optical illusions or some malfunction of the instrumentation. In order to be confident that you're seeing something really unusual, you have to have full control over the instrument. And that is done in any scientific experiment where you put the instrument on a solid foundation and you monitor what they're doing. And that's what our telescope system is all about. It's not, military cameras, they were designed for a battlefield for a completely different purpose, not to find the nature of objects that behave in an unusual fashion. So they are not really suitable for scientific investigation. You can't conclude that the laws of physics are broken just by looking at images taken by military instrumentation, because that instrumentation was not monitored in the way that a scientific experiment is done, and you can't be confident as to what you're seeing. At least the data that was released to the public, I don't know, maybe there is some better data that the government owns and we haven't seen it. But the point is, we in the Galileo project will have full control over the instrumentation. The instruments will be much higher quality than those that were used in the data that was reported so far. And therefore, we hope to get much better data. And when the images are much clearer and we know exactly what the camera was doing when the image was taken, then we can discuss whether, we will start by assuming that the laws of physics are correct. Because so far, whenever laboratory experiments were done, the laws of physics held. Claiming that the laws of physics are broken is a much more revolutionary claim than saying that UAP are extraterrestrial, because the laws of physics apply to the entire universe. If you say something is new about how physics works, you have to understand there is a huge number of experiments done so far in laboratories that haven't found. In fact, we invested $10 billion in the Large Hadron Collider. Except for discovering the Higgs that was anticipated, we haven't really found any new physics there. $10 billion, nothing. Now you're claiming, because of a jittery camera in a cockpit, there is new physics. That is not a way to figure out new physics. So with the Galileo project, we will actually monitor our instruments. We will be able to tell, if there is something really unusual happening that cannot be described by the laws of physics. But before we go there, we need to do an experiment that is fully controlled. And that's what we plan to do.
You have a caller waiting to talk to you on the line. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John. You're on with Dr. Loeb.
Yes. I was sort of, this project you had early on, I know you were looking at the Muamura issue, and that fit into the category of something that definitely would fit into, like you said, known laws of physics, because it's an object that might have been launched millions of years ago from some other solar system, if it was artificial, taking that into account, and just happened to be derelict at this point and flew through ours on some kind of hyperbolic trajectory, right? But when you were talking about these UAPs in the atmosphere that have been widely reported and so forth over the years, that's a totally different animal, so to speak.
Yeah, it is different, and because if you imagine technological equipment hovering just over Earth, being within the atmosphere of Earth, then it should be functional. It must be functional. It must be, in some sense, intelligent, maybe artificial, has artificial intelligence, if it's real, okay? Whereas something like Oumuamua could be just space trash. You know, if you think about Voyager that we launched out of the solar system, eventually, you know, within a billion years from now, it will not be functional anymore. It will be just space trash. And there could be many such objects like Voyager that are already a billion years old, came from other civilizations and floating through space. And perhaps Oumuamua was one of them, okay? So we can find things flying through space into the solar system and out that are not functional, that are just debris, you know, things left over, you know, just like finding trash on the beach, you know, plastic bottles that are not usable anymore. So there could be a lot of those. I agree with you, that would be of a different, completely different nature than an object that is completely functional and is trying to seek some seeking some information about us and is close to Earth. So UAP are definitely, I mean, if they are associated with extraterrestrial equipment, they are of very different nature. That's clear. But it's also possible that Oumuamua had been functional. You know, maybe it was collecting information about the habitable zone of the solar system. I wouldn't rule it out. So the key is really getting more data, getting better evidence, such that, you know, if we get a high-resolution image of an object like Oumuamua or of a UAP, we get a megapixel image of an object like that, it would be clear whether it's natural, whether it's a rock, or whether it has bolts and screws on it, whether you can read off the label made on exoplanet Y. And when we have such an image, I don't think anyone would argue with it. So that's why I'm saying it's not a philosophical question. It's a very practical question. Let's just get that image. That's all. Why do we need to speculate? Why do we need to argue about it? You see, the scientists, many of them, ridicule the subject, and then the public is left to speculate, and they feed each other. It's sort of like polarization in politics, that the two extremes feed each other. One side says, look at those extremists, and the other side, look at those extremists. And the same, you know, on this subject, you know, the people that ridicule it feed those that speculate about it. And I say, forget about it. This is not a political argument. This is not a philosophical argument. Let's just get a high-resolution image, and we'll figure it out once and for all, and that's it. You know, and that's the way science is done, just getting more evidence. We are not in the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages right now. You know, we have the instrumentation. We just need to do the experiment and figure out what these are. That's it.
I fully agree. I think you have a very good approach there. I mean, if we can actually get these things, and I guess you got enough of those telescopes like you're talking about. I saw some of your other interviews on that. Then you could get high-resolution photographs, unlike the blurry ones that everybody complains about.
Right.
And that would give you...
It's possible that the government has some photographs that they don't release to the public because they're classified. It's possible. But we will never get to see them because the government will never release those. So rather than waiting for Godot, you know, there is this play that Samuel Beckett wrote, Waiting for Godot. Rather than waiting forever for the government to declassify, begging them to declassify, why do we need to do that? Let's just get our act together and use some high-resolution telescopes that are big enough to give us good images and figure out what these things are.
Yeah. I was also noticed that you've brought Christopher Mellon and Louis Elizondo into your project.
Yeah, so we have a very I established a big tent that includes people from both sides of the argument. There are people that are advocates for an extraterrestrial technological origin of these UAP, like Chris Mellon or Louis Elizondo. But there are also people that are skeptics, like Michael Shermer, and you know, but I brought both sides of the argument because I think, you know, once we get good enough data, we will be able to figure both sides will converge. You know, that they will not be able to dispute what the data is telling us. So that bringing both sides allows me to be confident that we are not missing anything. We are not missing any argument. And the beauty of science is that with good enough evidence, everyone agrees. That's the beauty of science. Unlike politics, you know, people can disagree forever.
Yeah,
in science, if you have good enough data, eventually everyone agrees.
Well, one thing about, the thing about Christopher Mellon particularly is that he was the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence in the DOD, a very highly classified individual. If the government knows a lot more, he can't tell you because of security.
No.
Do you think he really knows the answer, or do you think maybe...
Well, okay, so here is the problem with any relation to the government. People sign NDA, non-disclosure agreement.
Right.
As a result, they are legally handcuffed. Basically, they cannot say anything. Okay, so he doesn't tell me anything he knows from that side of the fence. And
he can't tell you, I know. But do you think he knows? Is that your sense, or do you think he really doesn't know, even in his position?
John, let him talk. John.
Oh, sorry, sir.
Yeah, and I don't want to know any classified data because it will limit my ability to function as a free scientist. So. The point is, we don't talk about that, okay? And the reason that we have him and Lou Elizondo is simply give us advice about which locations we might want to put the telescope systems in, what are the societal implications, and other, sort of general topics that come up in the discussions, but nothing to do with the classified information that they may be aware of, because we are planning to get our own data.
Well, that makes sense, because otherwise that's what you can do in the world we're in. I agree with that. You can just get your own data. And I wasn't trying to suggest that he would do that. I was just kind of – but you sometimes do have a sense of what people – because I'm like – or it may just be, like I said, that he's mentioned in some interviews that he had personal experience – sighting, I think, as youth. So, that may be his motivation and maybe nothing from official knowledge. I fully understand that. I'm just
he or anyone else never relayed any classified information, and I'm not asking for it, and I'm not interested in it.
Yeah, I'm sure he wouldn't do that, but I'm trying to make a difference. Just the fact is that these people are that involved in it always seems to give me a hint that they may know something, but they know they can't talk. I've been under security in my job for years, and I can't talk about certain things too. I understand that fully. I think you've got a good approach. I just wanted to check in.
That's exactly why NDAs and classified information are not part of the Galileo project, because science is supposed to be open and transparent. And by the way, if there is something that is of extraterrestrial technological origin, it's not a matter of national security, because anything extraterrestrial does not care about the national borders, between nations here. It's just like you were to visit the jungle, you won't care which tree a chimpanzee is sitting on. So it's not a matter of national security simply because it doesn't adhere to national borders, this issue. It's just like any other topic that science is engaged in. It's international. So scientific knowledge is supposed to be shared by all humans, irrespective of national borders. So anything to do with classification because of national security concerns has nothing to do with the science, okay? If it's an extraterrestrial origin, it has to be dealt scientifically in an open fashion so that everyone can see the data, everyone can discuss and analyze it, and that's what we aim to bring to the table.
Yeah, but you have to admit that the governments have been very unwilling to be open about this subject for a long time.
I don't care about it. Just imagine sitting at the dinner table as a kid, okay, and people tell you stories about the family history, and you just want to know, the truth. You just want to know what something is. You don't care about the family history and the fact that there was a grandfather that misbehaved and another person that got into an argument with. Who cares about this? It's just a waste of our time. Okay, if you ask me what I am in spirit, I'm basically like a kid. I just want to figure out what these things are. I don't care about the history, about the arguments that people had about it, about the calculations that other people. I just want a megapixel image. Give me a megapixel image of these objects, and I'll be happy. I won't write any book because everyone can look at that image. A picture is worth 1,000 words. In my case, the pictures were 66,000 words. I would never write the book Extraterrestrial if I had a high-resolution image of Oumuamua. So my point is simple. Let's just get that image rather than argue forever, rather than talk about what the government did 50 years ago. I don't care about these things. You know, it's much more important to know whether there is something out there, what the nature of this something is, and if it ends up being natural or human-made, we'll figure it out and move on. You know, I don't care if that's the answer, if it's not extraterrestrial. And if it is extraterrestrial, obviously it would make a huge difference for our future. So let's just figure it out rather than argue forever and talk about history.
Okay, well, I think you have a very good approach and you're maintaining objectivity, which is kind of critical in a thing of this sort. So,
anything else, John?
I think I'll get off and see if somebody else wants to call in.
Thank you. Listeners, you too can call and talk to Dr. Loeb. Our toll-free line is 866-687-7223. Avi, I have a Dennis email from Tucson, Arizona, and he says, Professor, many people believe that these objects might be dark or black military equipment or technology, maybe from a different country than the United States. But were that to be true, and I have no idea if it is true, would your telescopes, would your process be able to detect that this was dark projects, dark creations, products from different governments? I'm trying to edit it on the fly. It's a very long email.
Yeah.
Could you pick it up, or could you be interfered with and manipulated by that part of the government and you wouldn't even know it?
Well, if we do see something that is human-made, I don't have any interest in it, and I'll be glad to transfer the data directly to Washington, D.C. There are people there that care a lot about it. So if we clearly can tell that it's human-made because it behaves in ways that human technology behaves, you know, we know pretty much the limits of human-made technologies. So if it's within that bracket of human-made technologies, I don't care about it. It's just, it's as boring to me as a bird. Okay, if we see a bird, that even, you know, if the bird is beautiful, I don't care much about it. I'll transfer that information to a zoologist. I don't need to, you know. So now it may well be that there are some human-made objects that at the very least civilians did not really know about, and because they are of military significance. But my point is the Director of National Intelligence, you know, who is she is supposed to know everything, right? And she would never talk about objects whose nature we cannot really identify to Congress. If it, you know, so there are two interpretations of that. Okay, the U.S. has intelligence, and that intelligence is not good enough because, as your listener is saying, some of these objects may be off, you know, came from other nations. So that would be bad news for the intelligence services of the U.S., right?
If we
can't really tell what is being used against us, that's bad news. And I have a hard time believing that. But that's important to figure out, right? So if our telescopes find these things and we inform the government that they missed on the interpretation, that's also important, right? So scientists are helping the government to figure out something the government didn't really figure out, that other nations are more advanced than we ever imagined, okay? So that's possibility number one. My point is, it would never have been reported to Congress if it was obvious or possible, even possible, that Russia or China are making this. It would not be there because, you know, things related to Russia and China and other nations are discussed all the time, nonstop, okay, in the government. So if it was possible or likely, that would never appear in a report of this type, okay? Because the government is doing that and claiming that it is human-made and the government just didn't figure it out. You know, it's a big myth on the intelligence. And if the scientists find out that is a contribution to national security, a major contribution that science can bring, and why not? You know, that would be a plus. But I have a hard time believing it, okay? And then the second possibility, of course, is No, it's not human-made, but it is technological, okay? And in that case, we're talking about something else. And that would be of greater significance because it will not be a matter of national security. It will be a matter of international interest. It's a scientific matter. And so my point is everything is possible, and we will know more when we have better data. And the government already has better data. There is no doubt about it that the public just saw the tip of the iceberg because most of the iceberg is classified. But my point is, if most of the iceberg is classified, why would the government report to Congress that there are some objects that they cannot identify? That would make very little sense.
Well,
if it were human-made.
Not only that, but if they do have classified data, I seriously doubt they're going to discuss it in congressional hearings. So
right.
I'm not sure what they're referring to. Congress is going to amount to it very much. So, I mean,
right.
That's my own thought. Beverly is in Seattle, and she says, I have a question about your telescopes going up on the roof of the Harvard Observatory building. I don't really know what the weather is, and I don't know to where you're trying to find the objects in and around Cambridge, but is the weather, is the atmosphere, is the location for your first system a limitation?
Oh, no. So I should clarify that the location was just chosen so that we can test that the system works. It's not because we really want to monitor the sky above Cambridge. I mean, as the listener says, that sky is cloudy a lot of the time. There is nothing particularly interesting over there. It's unlikely that we will see anything of interest. That's not the reason we do it there. We do it there just to test the system. So basically put together those building blocks of infrared cameras, optical camera, radio sensors, and audio sensors, and just put them together and see that they work and that the artificial intelligence algorithms identify the type of objects we see. So basically it's a practice run. It has nothing to do with the goal of identifying UAP, okay? And we will use a drone just to check that we can see things. If we control the drone, we can check if the system, how the system sees it and so forth. So that would be the practice run that we hope to do by the summer of 2022. The location is not at all a good location, okay? But then once it works, the system works, then we will bring it to a better location, and then we will make copies of it and put them in many other locations as well.
Another email, and listeners, you ought to use the phone. It is Sunday. Come on, you can't be at work. 866-687-7223. Bob is in Memphis with an email, and he says, I'm aware of your involvement with Breakthrough. We have heard from Dr. Lubin on the show, Pete Warden, many times. Most of us are very familiar with the Breakthrough projects. How do you associate your work with Breakthrough and trying to develop interstellar wafers or something to travel to a nearby star system and looking for some kinds of objects that may already know how to do that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So the Breakthrough Starshot Initiative is basically our project to reach the stars. Okay, so that's the first time where there is a funded project to design a mission that would reach the nearest star within our lifetime. Okay, so we're struggling with the underlying technologies of a light sail and the laser that will push it and so forth. And we are really making the first baby steps in this direction. But you have to remember that our science and technology, the modern science, was developed only over the past century. Okay, so we are really at the beginning of a long journey. There is a real possibility that another civilization had a much more time than a century. Okay, so if the star that hosts them was born a billion years before the sun, just think about how much more we will advance in a billion years. Our technologies are advancing exponentially every few years. And so my point is wait for our civilization to, in principle, reach the state that they reached a billion years from now, but we can do that, or we can continue to monitor the sky and see anything that they sent and perhaps learn from that. So that will give us a jump start. That will give us a shortcut towards the solution if we find equipment that other civilizations produced a long time ago. And so I'm interested in both approaches. You know, on the one hand, given that we haven't found for sure any equipment from them, we should follow our own understanding of physics and develop our own missions. But if we happen to find through the Galileo project something produced by another civilization that is more advanced than we are, definitely we will use that knowledge to shape our ambitions in the future. We need to learn from any smarter kid on the block. And you know, it may feel like cheating in an exam, like you're looking over the shoulder of the student next to you to find the answer. I don't care if it saves us a million years in the process, so be it.
Well, do you think that you and your associates would be able to comprehend and reverse engineer and break down technology that's a billion years advanced in the future?
Well, that's an excellent question, because it all depends, and I actually wrote an essay about that a week ago. It all depends on the gap. How big is the technological gap between what we find from another civilization and what we are able to produce? Because think about a cave dweller that finds a cell phone, you know, or think about a cave dweller that came to visit New York City, Manhattan, okay, goes in the streets and then comes back to the cave. Would you imagine that this cave dweller would be able to reconstruct what he or she saw in the Big Apple? Probably not.
No.
That experience of seeing Manhattan would translate to some myth or story in the culture after he or she reports back to the tribe that they came from. It will be a myth. It will be some story about them, something really peculiar that was found. But they will not be able to reverse engineer everything they see. And the same is true about the cell phone. If they find a cell phone somewhere, at first they would say, well, it's a shiny rock, because that's what they've seen before. And that's what my colleagues argued that Oumuamua was, a rock of a type that we've never seen before. But even if they press the button and record their voice, and I mean, for them to reconstruct the electronics of a cell phone, that would never happen. You know, it would take a huge amount of time for them to build the infrastructure that can lead to the production of a cell phone. And that could take a huge amount of time. So my guess is if the technological gap is too big, we will not figure out how to make the things that we find. Okay, we will just find them. They would not look natural. They would not look like human-made things. And then that's the end of it. And they could look like a miracle, like something that we've never imagined. So in terms of retro or reverse engineering, it really depends on how much more advanced it is. And until we find it, we would not know.
Would you recognize it then if you found it?
Oh, yeah. So that's my point. The way to recognize is to basically say that it's not natural and not human-made. That's it. That's the way Sherlock Holmes operated, you know, in the story as a detective. He basically put all the possibilities on the table and then rule out one by one, and whatever remains must be the truth, okay? So if it's not human-made and it's not natural, it must be something else. Now, we may not figure out what it is exactly, how it works. That's a separate matter, but saying that it's extraterrestrial technological equipment, that's something we can say. Just like the cave dweller can say, you know, the cell phone is not a rock.
So I have another angle to this. This is my own little jewel. Let's say you do find something that you know qualifies as having a technological gap, and you're looking at it from a science perspective. But what about other disciplines? So let's say this advanced culture that made this device also has advanced medical knowledge. Let's say that they can, you know, they know how to cure cancer, or they can absolutely reverse cystic fibrosis or reverse heart disease, or you name it, you know. Would that kind of information be embedded in what you found, or would you not even have a clue about it, or how do you know, or am I just dreaming? I mean, it seems to me that they might, if it is that advanced with technology, embedded in that technology might be a whole bunch of other information we want.
Yeah, of course, there may be a message in the bottle that they could bring us to our salvation, but most likely, I would think of it as the encounter between ants on the sidewalk and someone that just walks by, because in principle, you know, you can think about the protocol that the ants might adapt to behave in a way that reflects their interest when someone walks on the pavement, and they would have committees and discuss what to do if a person walks on the street, okay? But who cares about it? The person will do whatever they want. You know, they can step on the ants irrespective of what protocol the ants would take, okay, would adopt.
Right.
And so my point is, it's not at all clear that if they're much more advanced than we are, that they care about us, that they will affect our bodies in any way, that they would collect information in order to negotiate or discuss things with us. It's not, I mean, these are concepts that are centered on us. So, you know, we tend to think that everything centers on us because, you know, that's how we started. We thought that we are the center of the world. Then we said, okay, not the center of the world. I mean, at first, of course, Galileo was put in house arrest, arguing that we are at the center of the world. But then the evidence became so clear that we realized we are not at the center of the world. So a lot of people said, even just 50 years ago, a lot of scientists argued, well, the Earth-Sun system must be rare. You know, it could be rare. It's even, you know, we shouldn't discuss the possibility that it's common. And then, of course, by now we know that half of the Sun-like stars have a planet the size of the Earth, roughly the same separation. So what we find in our backyard is not really unique, privileged. And this lesson comes back again and again. It's not about us. We are not important. We are not privileged. Nobody cares about us. And that's a message that you keep hearing, but humans keep thinking, oh, no, we are central players. They must think about us. They must spy on us. They must want to do this and that to us. No, we are not that significant. If I were to guess, I would argue we are just the ants on the sidewalk. Now, what happens to us really depends on them. It's not a matter of the protocol we adopt, and it really depends on what their ambitions, goals are. And we better find out which environment we live in, of course. That's the goal here. But we shouldn't believe that it will anything that happens around us is because of us. We just came to the scene relatively recently, you know, just over the past million years or so. That's a small fraction of the age of the universe. It's one part in 10,000. So Homo sapiens, for the vast majority of the history of the universe, Homo sapiens were not existent. Human history that is documented is only documented over the past 10,000 years, which is 1 millionth of the age of the universe. So we really came late, and therefore we cannot be the main players in this play. Okay, and we are not at the center of the stage. So let's just realize that you know, we just came recently. We don't really know what happened here. And so let's keep our eyes open rather than think that everything is centered on us. You know, I can understand why you think that, because my daughters, when they were young, they tended to think that everything centers on them and that they are the smartest in the neighborhood, until we took them to the kindergarten. And then that experience was traumatic for them. But we better adapt that strategy out of modesty. You know, we better think, let's start from scratch. Nothing around us is special, unique, privileged. It's not about us. Okay, let's just look around and figure out where we are, rather than argue that we are really important.
Rodney is in Salt Lake City, Utah, for a question for you. And he says, if Mr. Musk does succeed in moving lots and lots of people to live on Mars, and somehow they prevail and live on Mars, have you thought about whether 100 years later those Martians would be an advanced technology compared to those of us that remained on Earth? And how would they evolve and go forward? Do you give any thought to that?
Well, yeah. Well, first of all, I should say it's very naive to suggest that a lot of people will live on the surface of Mars, because Mars doesn't have an atmosphere. It has a very thin atmosphere. It doesn't have a strong magnetic field. So there are energetic particles bombarding the surface of Mars, and a human cannot survive there for more than a few years because of the damage by these energetic particles. So in order for a human to survive on Mars, the human needs to go down underground into a cave that where the extra layer of rock would protect his or her body from the cosmic rays. So there is a whole level of protection that needs to be built into the infrastructure of whatever is happening on Mars. And that was not really discussed by Elon Musk or others that are talking about moving to Mars. And I think it's sort of childish to imagine that we could survive there unless we build the infrastructure health-wise, protecting the health of people. It will be a one-way trip into their death, you know, if we send them there without building the infrastructure. So that's a major obstacle that was not really addressed publicly. Okay, maybe people discuss it, behind the closed doors, I don't know, but dreaming about putting a lot of people there before solving this issue is making the idea of populating Mars a pipe dream. And for now, we have the Earth, okay? So I think a better approach to space would be to send artificial intelligence astronauts. These are systems that they are not humans, not biological, because we humans, you know, we were selected by Darwinian evolution to survive on the surface of Earth, okay? And we don't do well in space over long periods of time. So it makes much more sense to send equipment and by now, you know, we have artificial intelligence driving cars, and you can imagine sending it to space in the form of AI astronauts that will be autonomous. Such systems will learn from experience and do better than human astronauts. I don't see a reason to send humans to space. I would be very proud of AI astronauts going to space and populating Mars and doing whatever we want, not humans. I'm happy to send technological kids to space, and I will be very proud of that, of them, because they will do better than human astronauts. So instead of Elon Musk's dream of sending a lot of humans, I would send AI astronauts that will represent us and could survive in the harsh conditions of space and will do the job that we want to do out there. They can even carry 3D printers that will make things that we want over there. Why risk humans?
Well, if that's the case, then I would think that would hold for other civilizations to send their AI astronauts out there. Why don't we find any remnants of them?
No, that's exactly right. That's why I think if we have an encounter with equipment of the type that the Galileo project is searching for, it will most likely be with AI astronauts of other civilizations, not with biological creatures, because those would not survive the journey. The journey is very long. So you just argued exactly my point, that we might see intelligent equipment that is equipped with the artificial intelligence that we will need to interpret, but it will not be biological creatures. That's my guess, that if we see intelligent behavior, it will be of some instrumentation, some equipment that has artificial intelligence. And in order to interpret the intent of that, we might need our own AI system to figure out what their AI systems are doing.
So how are we doing on the technology for AI astronauts in 2022?
I should say that, you know, I argued for that. I suggested that also at the Washington National Cathedral. We had a forum with Jeff Bezos and Avery Haines and Bill Nelson, where I talked about it. And we're not there yet. I mean, AI systems are still developed for, you know, driving cars and things on Earth. I believe in the future they will reach space, and I'm advocating for that. There is no reason why we would not send AI astronauts that learn from experience. You know, right now the Perseverance rover is a robot, okay, but it gets its guidance from the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. So there are engineers there that tell the robot what to do. That's a very efficient way of handling equipment in space, especially if it goes large distances. You know, there is no way for it to wait for the guidance from the sender. It needs to be intelligent enough to do the right thing. And that's, you know, AI systems could be autonomous. They could learn from experience and just operate on their own. And I think that's the future of space exploration.
Larry is in Atlanta and says, do you have any kind of reasonable or plausible timeline where you might have some answers once you get going?
Yeah, so I can say what my hope is, and of course reality could be different, but my hope is that within a year or two, we will have some very useful data, and that will already shed some light on this question. And it all depends on how much funding we get and whether we have a large enough number of telescope systems. But it also depends on how many low-hanging fruits are out there, you know. So it may well be once we put the first telescope system in the appropriate location that we will immediately see things that look unusual, and I would call it low-hanging fruit. And it's possible that we will find it just because we are taking the path that was not taken. You know, like in the poem of Robert Frost, he said that the two roads bifurcated in the woods, and he took the path that was not taken, and that made all the difference. And for me, taking the road not taken with the Galileo project offers the benefit that we might find low-hanging fruit because nobody walked in that path to pick up those fruits. So if we are lucky, if we go to the right place at the right time and we see something unusual, maybe within a year we could see something. But if we are not so lucky, it could take another year or a few more years. It all depends also on how much funding we get so that we can cover a large enough portion of the sky. And my hope is that we will get there within the coming years.
Where do you go from the rooftops of Harvard? Do you already have your locations picked up?
Well, there are some locations that were sort of hotspots, and they were represented in reports we heard about, for example, the Nimitz report, you know, that's the area over there in Southern California. But there are other areas that where a lot of reports came from. My hope is to have enough funding to have hundreds of telescope systems such that we will cover a very broad swath of territory that we can say we have very good statistics on these unidentified objects.
Listeners, there's still time if you would like to call 1-866-687-7223. What is your plan on reporting and getting the information back to people? Are you planning a newsletter? Are you planning PR conferences? How is the information going to be distributed back to the public?
Yeah, so we will do it in the standard scientific way. Basically, at first, we collect the data, and then there would be a period of time where we verify that the data is real, that it's not an artifact, that we understand the way it was collected, that we can trust it. And then we will interpret it and write scientific papers about it. And depending on the content of those papers. We will have potentially also a press release. But the point is, we will make the data available to anyone after we prepare those scientific papers so that anyone can analyze the same data and reach whatever conclusions they reach with it. So we will make our analysis transparent, the data open, but there will be an initial period of time where we just need to verify that we are not distributing data that is not reliable. You know, so there would be some delay between the time that the data is collected and then distributed to the public, just to allow us to verify that we can trust it.
Would you do conferences on it or anything more?
Oh yeah,
like that?
We will aside from writing scientific papers that will be published in peer-reviewed journals. We will also have media releases and discuss it with the public. Yes, definitely.
Claude wants to email you, Dallas, Texas, and I guess email prevails today over phone calls. Claude says there are reports, and I have no idea if they're authentic or not, that there is metamaterial from downed or crashed items dating back to the Roswell era, but also including the Navy Tic Tac era. Do you have any information about materials from downed craft, and is that part of what you're looking into?
Well, that's a subject that was studied by Gary Nolan from Stanford, and he's a member of the Galileo Project, and you might want to direct your question to him. He published a scientific paper on that in Science magazine. And the point is, the Galileo Project is aiming to identify objects that are in the sky, not debris or relics, but at this time. If one of these objects that behaves in an unusual way, one of them crashes, then of course we will go there and check what it's made of. Definitely, that's why we have Gary Nolan in our team. I would be delighted to put my hands on it. You know, that if we can press a button and see what it does, that would be fantastic. And obviously, it will. You know, if it crashes on the ground, we can definitely say whether it's human made or natural or something else. You know, that obviously that would be of great significance, but the claims that exist are still ambiguous. You know, we don't know for sure if those relics that people claim, you know, where did they come from, what the origin is, what the interpretation is. But there are some intriguing facts that, for example, were analyzed by Gary Nolan. Yes.
You're not being directed to any specific metamaterials at this time, right?
No. I don't know if such things exist. Again, if they are classified, I avoid any classified data.
You mentioned volunteers. Are you looking for high-level skilled volunteers or worker bees? Or if people are interested in the subject and they want to volunteer, can they volunteer? Or
We have a form on the Galileo Project website that allows anyone to apply to be a volunteer, and then there is a small committee within the Galileo Project that screens anyone that applies. And the form basically asks for your expertise and how you wish to contribute to the project. And so definitely there is a channel for people interested in contributing to just fill the form and we will let you know.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. So, listeners, on their website, it's under Get Involved, and you will see the form. How is the funding going so far? Are you on target? Do you have fundraising goals? Are you doing any kind of Kickstarter kind of project to help out? Anything like that?
Yeah. Well, I have some contacts that I'm pursuing in terms of wealthy individuals that might contribute. But at the moment, we would value, of course, any significant contribution to the project. And it will be used directly to purchase instrumentation and build up the infrastructure that I was talking about so that we can get good data. And I very much hope we will have more donations. And there are many people excited by the goals of the project, and we would love to get any interested person engaged and benefit from more contributions, because the goal is 100 million. We have just 2 million at the moment, so definitely we will benefit if more wealthy individuals contributed.
I'm curious, when you talk to wealthy or substantial individuals, do you find a lot of people have interest in this topic and this kind of a project? I'm just curious as to what the interest lies.
Well, it's split. I mean, there are people that care a lot about it, and there are some that do not, that believe that, oh, probably there is nothing behind it. The approach that we are taking is, you know, we don't know in advance what we will find, and we just follow the scientific method. So even those that doubt that such UAP are of extraterrestrial technological origin, they should be happy to support the project, because that would clear the fog. Once and for all, we will know. Okay, so if they think, oh, there is not, these UAP are just human-made or natural, in order for us to find out this, we need to use the scientific method to get better data. And if they support the project, we will report whatever we find. So we don't have an agenda. And we should be supported by doubters as much as by believers in the extraterrestrial technological origin. And I would think that everyone should be interested in clearing up the fog and figuring out what these objects are so that we can move on.
Jim sent in an email, and listeners, were coming up on the end of the discussion. So, again, if you're interested in calling, you need to do so. 1-866-687-7223. Jim says, have you heard of Erling Strand of Project Hesseldalen? I'm not familiar with any of this, by the way. Would you be interested in inviting him to the project?
How do you spell the last name again?
Strand is S-T-R-A-N-D. It's Erling, E-R-L-I-N-G, and it's Project Hesseldalen, H-E-S-S-D as in David, A-L-E-N.
No, I haven't heard about this project. I will be glad to learn more about it and see what it's about.
Okay, so Jim, if you post something on the blog, we can get more information about it, and thank you for that. Christy is a Denver, Colorado graduate student, and she says, I'm a physics graduate student, and I'm just wondering what the attitude of your typical physics student might be about this type of project.
Well, that's very interesting, because there are a lot of students involved in the Galileo project, and there were at least four undergraduates at Harvard University who approached me with the interest to be engaged. And I think young people are very excited about the goals of the Galileo project, and they don't carry a baggage of past history, and they just want to figure out, you know, there aren't many topics that are of such impact on society, whether we find it to be one thing or another, you know. And science should be relevant to society. If the government is not clear about this subject, then that's an excellent opportunity for scientists to explain to the government what these things are. And how many examples do we have of topics in physics or science where people in society, where at the dinner table, if you speak with your parents or some family relative, you can actually talk about it and they would care about it. You know, if you talk about the mass of the neutrino or the magnetic moment of the muon or, you know, things like that, nobody would raise an eyebrow at the dinner table. I mean, obviously for physicists, these are details that they care a lot about, but they don't impact the daily lives of people. However, the possibility that there is an extraterrestrial technological civilization, you know, that's a subject everyone cares about, and everyone understands the importance of. And here is a scientific project, the first one, that actually tries to collect data in the scientific method about it. So to me, it sounds like a no-brainer that people should be excited about it. And the young people are. And so that's my experience, that I got a lot of emails from young people. Of course, the older people, they are attached to their image. They are really cautious whether to say something good about it because, you know, the, there is a lot of stigma on this subject. But I, in my fundamental attitude to science, I'm a young person. You know, I don't care how many likes I get on Twitter. That's completely irrelevant. I just want to know the truth. You know, I just want to figure it out. And science can be exciting. Why should science be always boring?
I'll take the liberty of asking the last question unless one comes in and bumps me out of line. But over the 20-plus years of doing the space show, there is a spiritual component to people who like to do things in space. And certainly in the UFO movement, which we're not really talking about, there is a godlike spiritual component to it, not with everybody, but with some people. And so I'm curious, you talk pure science, and I know I've read your work, and you are pure science, but do you, as a scientist, see any spiritual connection to possible extraterrestrials, to exploring out in the cosmos? And if so, does your idea of a spiritual connection have anything to do with a more or less traditional God concept of a Judeo-Christian society?
Well, I would say definitely a connection because, you know, I attended this forum at the Washington National Cathedral on November 10th, 2021, just about 4 months ago. And Jeff Bezos was talking about space tourism and as a business plan. And I was thinking to myself that there is no business plan to leaving the solar system. You can't make money out of a project to leave the solar system. The only reason we would do that is spirituality, because we would like to seek the unknown. We would like to understand something
right
about the unknown. That would be the reason for space exploration. It's completely wrong to imagine exploration of space driven by a business plan, by a commercial benefit. It can only be driven by spirituality if we really go the distance. And of course, you know, over the summer, there were a number of multi-billionaires that lifted their body about 1% of the Earth radius and were very proud of themselves. But, you know, going to space is not about showing off, because, you know, 1% of the Earth radius is not very impressive. You know, the universe is 10 to the power 19 times bigger than the Earth radius. So showing off in space is an oxymoron. In fact, space, it teaches us modesty. Okay, we are really a small component. And the only reason to explore it would be out of a sense of modesty. Let's figure out the neighborhood that we live in. And it's a spiritual quest, you know, to figure out the meaning of our life, the purpose of our life, and so forth. So that's the way I see it. And I was talking with two reverends at the Washington National Cathedral, and I was trying to argue that, you know, if there is another civilization far more advanced than we are technologically, perhaps they already figured out how to create synthetic life in the laboratory. We are getting close to that ourselves. And that is a quality we assign to God, at least in the biblical stories and so forth. And another thing they may have figured out, if they learn how to unify quantum mechanics and gravity, they may be able to create a universe, a baby universe, in the laboratory. So that's another quality we assign to God. So my point to those reverends was that an advanced scientific civilization could be a good approximation to what we called God, because they could have produced a baby universe in the laboratory. They could have produced life. These are qualities that we assign, the theologians assign to God. And therefore, there is a way to unify science with religion if science is advanced enough. And that connects to an extraterrestrial, the possibility of an extraterrestrial technological civilization, because maybe they reached much farther than we have reached so far. And when we find them, they would appear to us as an approximation to God.
Do you have time to take a phone call that's waiting for you?
Okay, yes, quickly.
Okay. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Quickly, please. Who are you and where are you?
Hi, this is John in Fremont.
Hi, John.
Avi, you talked mainly about looking for UAPs in the Earth's atmosphere. Can you talk to the other activities that Project Galileo is working on, like launch-ready space missions to chase down Oumuamua-type objects, and then also potential ETC satellites in Earth orbit?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So there are two branches to the Galileo project. Indeed, I talked mostly on the UAP, but the second branch, which is major, is actually sending a space mission to the next Oumuamua, coming close to it within 1,000 kilometers or so, such that we can take a close-up photograph of an object as weird as Oumuamua was. And that is an expensive space mission to rendezvous with the next Oumuamua. It may cost $500 million or so. And at the moment, what we are doing is designing the parameters of the mission. So that includes the trajectory that we want to take. So instead of chasing the object, we would basically discover it as it comes towards us and then rendezvous with it along its path. And then for that, we have to design the optimal trajectory to rendezvous with an object. And the second component of the design has to do with the instrumentation that we want to put on that mission. So we are working on both the components, and hopefully we'll make progress in the coming months. And then, of course, we will have to propose a mission to a funder that would support it. It's quite an expensive mission.
You mentioned there's another activity for objects in Earth orbit.
Well, so those we could potentially see from satellites that orbit the Earth, and we are planning to use satellite data. We have been in conversations with Planet Labs, and some of the satellite data can identify objects above the Earth's atmosphere. Again, it relates to a space mission that we might develop that would be able to look at the objects that are unusual, also orbiting Earth.
Thank you. Great show.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Okay. Dr. Loeb, thank you very much. I know you have another appointment, so you got to run, but very enlightening, and we'll stay in touch with you on it. And if we can be helpful in your goals and your fundraising, I hope we can do so. And again, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Okay. And listeners, that's going to be it for today. And Tuesday, our program is described on our website already, so check it out and come on board. And thank you to Dr. Loeb for being with us and all of you who called and sent in emails. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend. As always, please do keep looking up. Goodbye from Professor Loeb, David, and the Space Show.